Even the advanced religionist, although disbelieving in any great amount of interference by the gods in this age of the world, still thinks that in the beginning some god made the laws governing the universe. He believes that in consequence of these laws, a man can lift a greater weight with than without a lever. That this god so made matter and so established the order of things, that two bodies cannot occupy the same space at the same time. So that a body once put in motion will keep moving until it is stopped. So that it's a greater distance around than across a circle. So that a perfect square has four equal sides instead of five or seven. He insists that it took a direct interposition of providence to make the whole greater than a part, and that had it not been for this power superior to nature, twice one might have been more than twice two, and sticks and strings might have had only one end apiece. Like the old Scotch divine, he thanks God that Sunday comes at the end instead of the middle of the week, and that death comes at the close instead of at the commencement of life, thereby giving us time to prepare for that holy day and that most solemn event. These religious people see nothing but design everywhere, and personal intelligent interference in everything. They insist that the universe has been created, and that the adaptation of means to ends is perfectly apparent. They point us to the sunshine, to the flowers, to the April rain, and to all there is of beauty and of use in the world. Did it ever occur to them that a cancer is as beautiful in its development as is the reddest rose? That what they're pleased to call the adaptation of means to ends is as apparent in the cancer as in the April rain? How beautiful the process of digestion! By what ingenious methods the blood is poisoned so that the cancer shall have food? By what wonderful contrivances the entire system of man is made to pay tribute to this divine and charming cancer? See by what admirable instrumentalities it feeds itself from the surrounding quivering, dainty flesh. See how it gradually but surely expands and grows. By what marvelous mechanism it is supplied with long and slender roots that reach out to the most secret nerves of pain for sustenance and life. What beautiful colors it presents! Seen through the microscope, it is a miracle of order and beauty. All the ingenuity of man cannot stop its growth. Think of the amount of thought it must have required to invent a way by which the life of one man must be given to produce one cancer. Is it possible to look upon it and doubt that there is design in the universe, and that the inventor of this wonderful cancer must be infinitely powerful, ingenious, and good? We are told that the universe was designed and created, and that it is absurd to suppose that matter has existed from eternity, but that it is perfectly self-evident that a God has. Well, if a God created the universe, then there must have been a time when he commenced to create. Back of that time, there must have been an eternity, during which there had existed nothing, absolutely nothing, except the supposed God. According to this theory, this God spent an eternity, so to speak, in an infinite vacuum, and in perfect idleness. Admitting that a God did create the universe, the question then arises, of what did he create it? It certainly was not made of nothing. Nothing, considered in the light of raw material, is a most decided failure. It follows, then, that the God must have made the universe out of himself, he being the only existence. The universe is material, and if it was made of God, the God must have been material. With this very thought in his mind, Anaximander of Miletus said, "Creation is the decomposition of the infinite." It has been demonstrated that the earth would fall to the sun only for the fact that it is attracted by other worlds, and those worlds must be attracted by other worlds still beyond them, and so on without end. This proves the material universe to be infinite. If an infinite universe has been made out of an infinite God, how much of the God is left? The idea of a creative deity is gradually being abandoned, and nearly all truly scientific minds admit that matter must have existed from eternity. It is indestructible, and the indestructible cannot be created. It is the crowning glory of our century to have demonstrated the indestructibility and the eternal persistence of force. Neither matter nor force can be increased nor diminished. Force cannot exist apart from matter. Matter exists only in connection with force, and consequently, a force apart from matter and superior to nature is a demonstrated impossibility. Force, then, must have also existed from eternity, and could not have been created. Matter in its countless forms, from dead earth to the eyes of those we love, and force in all its manifestations, from simple motion to the grandest thought, deny creation and defy control. Thought is a form of force. We walk with the same force with which we think. Man is an organism that changes several forms of force into thought force. Man is a machine into which we put what we call food and produce what we call thought. Think of that wonderful chemistry by which bread was changed into the divine tragedy of Hamlet. A god must not only be material, but he must be an organism, capable of changing other forms of force into thought force. This is what we call eating. Therefore, if the god thinks, he must eat. That is to say, he must of necessity have some means of supplying the force with which to think. It is impossible to conceive of a being who can eternally impart force to matter, and yet have no means of supplying the force thus imparted. If neither matter nor force were created, what evidence have we then of the existence of a power superior to nature? The theologian will probably reply, we have law and order, cause and effect, and besides all this, matter could not have put itself in motion. Suppose, for the sake of argument, that there is no being superior to nature, and that matter and force have existed from eternity. Now suppose that two atoms should come together. Would there be an effect? Why, yes. Suppose they came in exactly opposite directions with equal force. They would be stopped, to say the least. This would be an effect. If this is so, then you have matter, force, and effect without a being superior to nature. Now suppose the two other atoms, just like the first two, should come together under precisely the same circumstances. Would not the effect be exactly the same? Yes. Like causes producing like effect is what we mean by law and order. Then we have matter, force, effect, law, and order without a being superior to nature. Now we know that every effect must also be a cause, and that every cause must also be an effect. The atoms coming together did produce an effect. And as every effect must also be a cause, the effect produced by the collision of the atoms must, as to something else, have been a cause. Then we have matter, force, law, order, cause, and effect without a being superior to nature. Nothing is left for the supernatural but empty space. His throne is a void. His boasted realm is without matter, without force, without law, without cause, and without effect. But who put all this matter in motion? If matter and force have existed from eternity, then matter must have always been in motion, for there can be no force without motion. Force is forever active, and there is and there can be no cessation. If, therefore, matter and force have existed from eternity, so has motion. In the whole universe there is not even one atom in a state of rest. A deity outside of nature exists in nothing and is nothing. Nature embraces with infinite arms all matter and all force. That which is beyond her grasp is destitute of both, and can hardly be worth the worship and adoration, even of a man. There is but one way to demonstrate the existence of a power independent of and superior to nature, and that is by breaking, if only for one moment, the continuity of cause and effect. Pluck from the endless chain of existence one little link, stop for one instant the grand procession, and you have shown beyond all contradiction that nature has a master. Change the fact just for 1 second that matter attracts matter, and a god appears. The rudest savage has always known this fact, and for that reason always demanded the evidence of miracle. The founder of a religion must be able to turn water into wine, cure with a word the blind and lame, and raise with a simple touch the dead to life. It was necessary for him to demonstrate to the satisfaction of his barbarian disciple that he was superior to nature. In times of ignorance, this was easy to do. The credulity of the savage was almost boundless. To him, the marvelous was the beautiful, the mysterious was the sublime. Consequently, every religion has for its foundation a miracle. That is to say, a violation of nature. That is to say, a falsehood. No one in the world's whole history ever attempted to substantiate a truth by a miracle. Truth scorns the assistance of a miracle. Nothing but falsehood ever attested itself by signs and wonders. No miracle ever was performed, and no sane man ever thought he had performed one. And until one is performed, there can be no evidence of the existence of any power superior to and independent of nature. The Church wishes us to believe. Well, let the Church or one of its intellectual saints perform a miracle, and we will believe. We're told that nature has a superior. Well, let the superior for one single instant control nature, and we will admit the truth of your assertions. We have heard talk enough. We have listened to all the drowsy, idealist, vapid sermons that we wish to hear. We have read your Bible and the works of your best minds. We have heard your prayers, your solemn groans, and your reverential amens. All these amount to less than nothing We want one fact. We beg at the doors of your churches for just one little fact. We pass our hats along your pews and under your pulpits and implore you for just one fact. We know all about your moldy wonders and your stale miracles. We want a this year's fact. We ask only one. Give us one fact for charity. Your miracles are too ancient. The witnesses have been dead for nearly 2,000 years. Their reputation for truth and veracity in the neighborhood where they resided is wholly unknown to us. Give us a new miracle and substantiate it by witnesses who still have the cheerful habit of living in this world. Do not send us to Jericho to hear the winding horns, nor put us in the fire with Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego. Do not compel us to navigate the sea with Captain Jonah, nor dine with Mr. Ezekiel. There is no sort of use in sending us fox hunting with Samson. We have positively lost all interest in that little speech so eloquently delivered by Balaam's inspired donkey. It is worse than useless to show us fishes with money in their mouths and to call our attention to vast multitudes stuffing themselves with 5 crackers and 2 sardines. We demand a new miracle, and we demand it now. Let the church furnish at least one, or forever after hold her peace. In the olden times, the church, by violating the order of nature, proved the existence of her God. At that time, miracles were performed with the most astonishing ease. They became so common that the church ordered her priests to desist. And now the same church, the people having found some little sense, admits not only that she cannot perform a miracle, but insists that the absence of miracle, the steady, unbroken march of cause and effect, proves the existence of a power superior to nature. The fact is, however, that the indissoluble chain of cause and effect proves exactly the contrary. Nature is but an endless series of efficient causes. She cannot create, but she eternally transforms. There was no beginning, and there can be no end. The best minds, even in the religious world, admit that in material nature there is no evidence of what they are pleased to call a god. They find their evidence in the phenomena of intelligence, and very innocently assert that intelligence is above and, in fact, opposed to nature. They insist that man, at least, is a special creation, that he has somewhere in his brain a divine spark, a little portion of the great first cause. They say that matter cannot produce thought, but that thought can produce matter. They tell us a man has intelligence, and therefore there must be an intelligence greater than his. Well, why not say that God has intelligence, and therefore there must be an intelligence greater than his? So far as we know, there is no intelligence apart from matter. We cannot conceive of thought except as produced within a brain. The science by means of which they demonstrate the existence of an impossible intelligence and an incomprehensible power is called metaphysics or theology. The theologians admit that the phenomena of matter tend, at least, to disprove the existence of any power superior to nature, because in such phenomena we see nothing but an endless chain of efficient causes, nothing but the force of a mechanical necessity. They therefore appeal to what they denominate the phenomena of mind to establish the superior power. The trouble is that in the phenomena of mind we find the same endless chain of efficient causes, the same mechanical necessity. Every thought must have had an efficient cause. Every motive, every desire, every fear, hope, and dream must have been necessarily produced. There is no room in the mind of man for providence or chance. The facts and forces governing thought are as absolute as those governing the motions of the planets. A poem is produced by the forces of nature and is as necessarily and naturally produced as mountains and seas. You will seek in vain for a thought in man's brain without a sufficient cause. Every mental operation is the necessary result of certain facts and conditions. Mental phenomena are considered more complicated than those of matter, and consequently more mysterious. Being more mysterious, they are considered as better evidence of the existence of a God. No one infers a God from the simple, from the known, from what is understood, but from the complex, from the unknown, and incomprehensible. Our ignorance is God. What we know is science. When we abandon the doctrine that some infinite being created matter and force, and enacted a code of laws for their government, the idea of interference will be lost. The real priest will then be not the mouthpiece of some pretended deity, but the interpreter of nature. From that moment the church ceases to exist. The tappers will die out upon the dusty altar. The moths will eat the fading velvet of pulpit and pew. The Bible will take its place with the Shastras, Puranas, Vedas, Edas, Sagas, and Qurans, and the fetters of a degrading faith will fall from the minds of men. But, says a religionist, you cannot explain everything. You cannot understand everything. And that which you cannot explain, that which you do not comprehend, is my God. We're explaining more every day. We are understanding more every day. Consequently, your God is growing smaller every day. Nothing daunted, the religionist then insists that nothing can exist without a cause, except cause, and that this uncaused cause is God. To this we again reply, every cause must produce an effect, because until it does produce an effect, it is not a cause. Every effect must in turn become a cause. Therefore, in the nature of things, there cannot be a last cause, for the reason that a so-called last cause would necessarily produce an effect, and that effect must of necessity become a cause. The converse of these propositions must be true. Every effect must have had a cause, and every cause must have been an effect. Therefore, there could have been no first cause. A first cause is just as impossible as a last effect. Beyond the universe, there is nothing, and within the universe, the supernatural does not and cannot exist. The moment these great truths are understood and admitted, a belief in general or special providence becomes impossible. From that instant, men will cease their vain efforts to please an imaginary being, and will give their time and attention to the affairs of this world. They will abandon the idea of attaining any object by prayer and supplication. The element of uncertainty will, in a great measure, be removed from the domain of the future, and man, gathering courage from a succession of victories over obstructions of nature, will attain a serene grandeur unknown to the disciples of any superstition. The plans of mankind will no longer be interfered with by the finger of a supposed omnipotence, and no one will believe that nations or individuals are protected or destroyed by any deity whatever. Science, freed from the chains of pious custom and evangelical prejudice, will, within her sphere, be supreme. The mind will investigate without reverence and publish its conclusions without fear. Agassiz will no longer hesitate to declare the Mosaic cosmogony utterly inconsistent with the demonstrated truths of geology, and will cease pretending any reverence for the Jewish scriptures. The moment science succeeds in rendering the church powerless for evil, the real thinkers will be outspoken. The little flags of truce carried by timid philosophers will disappear, and the cowardly parley will give place to victory, lasting and universal. If we admit that some infinite being has controlled the destinies of persons and peoples, history becomes a most cruel and bloody farce. Age after age, the strong have trampled upon the weak. The crafty and heartless have ensnared and enslaved the simple and innocent, and nowhere in all the annals of mankind has any god succored the oppressed. Man should cease to expect aid from on high. By this time he should know that heaven has no ear to hear and no hand to help. The present is the necessary child of all the past. There has been no chance, and there can be no interference. If abuses are destroyed, man must destroy them. If slaves are freed, man must free them. If new truths are discovered, man must discover them. If the naked are clothed, if the hungry are fed, if justice is done, if labor is rewarded, if superstition is driven from the mind, if the defenseless are protected, and if the right finally triumphs, all must be the work of man. The grand victories of the future must be won by man, and by man alone. Nature, so long as we can discern, without passion and without intention, forms, transforms, and retransforms forever. She neither weeps nor rejoices. She produces man without purpose and obliterates him without regret. She knows no distinction between the beneficial and the hurtful. Poison and nutrition, pain and joy, life and death, smiles and tears are alike to her. She is neither merciful nor cruel. She cannot be flattered by worship nor melted by tears. She does not even know the attitude of prayer. She appreciates no difference between poison in the fangs of snakes and mercy in the hearts of men. Only through man does nature take cognizance of the good, the true, and the beautiful. And so far as we know, man is the highest intelligence. And yet man continues to believe that there is some power independent of and superior to nature, and still endeavors by form, ceremony, supplication, hypocrisy, and sacrifice to obtain its aid. His best energies have been wasted in the service of this phantom. The horrors of witchcraft were all born of an ignorant belief in the existence of a totally depraved being superior to nature, acting in perfect independence of her laws. And all religious superstition has had for its basis a belief in at least two beings, one good and the other bad, both of whom could arbitrarily change the order of the universe. The history of religion is simply the story of man's efforts in all ages to avoid one of these powers and to pacify the other. Both powers have inspired little else than abject fear. The cold, calculating snare of the devil and the frown of God were equally terrible. In any event, man's fate was to be arbitrarily fixed forever by an unknown power superior to all law and to all fact. Until this belief is thrown aside, man must consider himself the slave of phantom masters, neither of whom promised liberty in this world, nor in the next. Man must learn to rely upon himself. Reading Bibles will not protect him from the blasts of winter, but houses, fires, and clothing will. To prevent famine, one plow is worth a million sermons, and even patent medicines will cure more diseases than all the prayers uttered since the beginning of the world. Although many eminent men have endeavored to harmonize necessity and free will, the existence of evil and the infinite power and goodness of God, they have succeeded only in producing learned and ingenious failures. Immense efforts have been made to reconcile ideas utterly inconsistent with the facts by which we are surrounded, and all persons who have failed to perceive the pretended reconciliation have been denounced as infidels, atheists, and scoffers. The whole power of the Church has been brought to bear against philosophers and scientists in order to compel a denial of the authority of demonstration, and to induce some Judas to betray reason, one of the saviors of mankind. During that frightful period known as the Dark Ages, faith reigned with scarcely a rebellious subject. Her temples were carpeted with knees, and the wealth of nations adorned her countless shrines. The great painters prostituted their genius to immortalize her vagaries, while the poets enshrined them in song. At her bidding, man covered the earth with blood. The scales of justice were turned with her gold, and for her use were invented all the cunning instruments of pain. She built cathedrals for God and dungeons for men. She peopled a cloud with angels, and the earth with slaves. For centuries, the world was retracing its steps, going steadily back toward barbaric night. A few infidels, a few heretics, cried halt to the great rabble of ignorant devotion, and made it possible for the genius of the 19th century to revolutionize the cruel creeds and superstitions of mankind. The thoughts of man, in order to be of any real worth, must be free. Under the influence of fear, the brain is paralyzed, and instead of bravely solving a problem for itself, tremblingly adopts the solution of another. As long as a majority of men will cringe to the very earth before some petty prince or king, what must be the infinite abjectness of their little souls in the presence of their supposed creator and God? Under such circumstances, what can their thoughts be worth? The originality of repetition and the mental vigor of acquiescence are all that we have any right to expect from the Christian world. As long as every question is answered by the word God, scientific inquiry is simply impossible. As fast as phenomena are satisfactorily explained, the domain of the power supposed to be superior to nature must decrease, while the horizon of the known must as constantly continue to enlarge. It is no longer satisfactory to account for the fall and rise of nations by saying it is the will of God. Such an explanation puts ignorance and education upon an exact equality, and does away with the idea of really accounting for anything whatever. Will the religionists pretend that the real end of science is to ascertain how and why God acts? Science, from such a standpoint, would consist in investigating the law of arbitrary action, and in a grand endeavor to ascertain the rules necessarily obeyed by infinite caprice. From a philosophical point of view, science is knowledge of the laws of life, of the conditions of happiness, of the facts by which we are surrounded, and the relations we sustain to men and things, by means of which man, so to speak, subjugates nature and bends the elemental powers to his will, making blind force the servant of his brain. A belief in special providence does away with the spirit of investigation, and is inconsistent with personal effort. Why should man endeavor to thwart the designs of God? Which of you, by taking thought, can add one cubit to his stature? Under the influence of this belief, man, basking in the sunshine of a delusion, considers the lilies of the field and refuses to take any thought for the morrow. Believing himself in the power of an infinite being, who can at any moment dash him to the lowest hell or raise him to the highest heaven, he necessarily abandons the idea of accomplishing anything by his own efforts. As long as this belief was general, the world was filled with ignorance, superstition, and misery. The energies of man were wasted in a vain effort to obtain the aid of this power, supposed to be superior to nature. For countless ages, even men were sacrificed upon the altar of this impossible God. To please him, mothers have shed the blood of their own babes. Martyrs have chanted triumphant songs in the midst of flame. Priests have gorged themselves with blood. Nuns have forsworn the ecstasies of love. Old men have tremblingly implored. Women have sobbed and entreated. Every pain has been endured, and every horror has been perpetrated. Through the dim long years that have fled, humanity has suffered more than can be conceived. Most of the misery has been endured by the weak, the loving, and the innocent. Women have been treated like poisonous beasts, and little children trampled upon as though they had been vermin. Numberless altars have been reddened, even with the blood of babes. Beautiful girls have been given to slimy serpents, whole races of men doomed to centuries of slavery, and everywhere there has been outrage beyond the power of genius to express. During all these years, the suffering have supplicated, the withered lips of famine have prayed, the pale victims have implored, and heaven has been deaf and blind. Of what use have the gods been to man? It is no answer to say that some god created the world, established certain laws, and then turned his attention to other matters, leaving his children weak, ignorant, and unaided, to fight the battle of life alone. It is no solution to declare that in some other world this god will render a few or even all his subjects happy. What right have we to expect that a perfectly wise, good, and powerful being will ever do better than he has done and is doing? The world is filled with imperfections. If it was made by an infinite being, what reason have we for saying that he will render it nearer perfect than it now is? If the infinite Father allows a majority of his children to live in ignorance and wretchedness now, what evidence is there that he will ever improve their condition? Will God have more power? Will he become more merciful? Will his love for his poor creatures increase? Can the conduct of infinite wisdom, power, and love ever change? Is the infinite capable of any improvement whatever? We're informed by the clergy that this world is a kind of school, that the evils by which we are surrounded are for the purpose of developing our souls, and that only by suffering can men become pure, strong, virtuous, and grand. Supposing this to be true, what is to become of those who die in infancy? The little children, according to this philosophy, can never be developed. They were so unfortunate as to escape the ennobling influences of pain and misery, and as a consequence are doomed to an eternity of mental inferiority. If the clergy are right on this question, none are so unfortunate as the happy, and we should envy only the suffering and distressed. If evil is necessary to the development of man in this life, how is it possible for the soul to improve in the perfect joy of paradise?